exemplify for us a relationship with the unseen. They teach us how to address the unseen. And the Prophet Muhammad had this extraordinary surrender. And in his surrender, when what will he had, and he had an extraordinary will, but it was a will in the service of the divine. It was not a self-will. Somebody read from Shamsi Tabriz this morning. Camille, last night, describing a relationship between a student and a master. And the master says, I'm going to Asheville. And the student says, well, I'm not. I have an excuse. And the master says, I'm trying to teach you union, and you're teaching me separation. These prophets were always came to unify people. They came to teach us the beauty of surrender. And the prophet, in the story of his life, is an example of someone who underwent many trials, tests, challenges, painful losses. But he lived in such a state of surrender that he was in this communication with the divine. And he would receive the guidance he needed because he was in that absolute trust. And now and then he'd make a small mistake. Like one day some people came and said, well, if you're a prophet, then you really ought to know why this and why this and why that and why this happened that way in the Old Testament. And he said, come back tomorrow and I'll tell you. My Lord will reveal it to me. So they came back the next day. This is one of the prophet's small mistakes. He had to make mistakes to teach us. They came back, he said, he hadn't received a revelation. He didn't have the answer to their question. And this went on, I think, for a long time, 30 days, maybe 60 days, when the revelation was cut off from the prophet. And then finally when the revelation started again, and here's an example of what I'm saying, that the relationship with the divine is not just a relationship with an abstract light or consciousness. When the revelation started again, it said to the Prophet Muhammad, remember to say, God willing. And then gave to him exactly the answers that were needed. But only after bringing him deeper into that state of surrender. So while we are not prophets, because we are not, we're not going to receive, I don't think anybody here or ever again is going to receive a revealed book the way Muhammad did, that is going to spawn a world religion. But the relationship of the revelatory power of this intelligence, it's called tajaliyat. No, it's called handing down. Tajaliyat is epiphany. It's when the radiance of the divine shines into this world. But the other word for revelation is to hand down. Truth is handed down. Guidance is handed down. In a very simple and beautiful verse in the Quran, it says, you know, God speaks in the royal we, or the divine we in the Quran, even though it's one, it speaks as we. It says, it is up to us to guide. It is up to us to guide. And what a simple but beautiful truth that suggests. It's up to you and me to ask for guidance. It's up to you and me to be mindful enough to receive guidance and slowly be raised stage by stage in all of the stages and degrees of our ever-maturing humanness. We are in the process of becoming fully mature human beings. And by mature human beings, I mean human beings that can handle the attributes of God appropriately in this life. That so-called enlightenment, which is sought on many paths, enlightenment as some sort of explosion of higher consciousness is one small aspect of that maturity. That to have enlightenment without maturity is a sad state. Maturity is handling the divine attributes appropriately in all our human relationships. And for that, we need exemplars. We need human beings who have lived beautifully. We need a Jesus. We need an Abraham. We need a Muhammad. We need a Rumi. These were all people who lived the truth that they communicated. I think this would be a good time. I'd like us to, I have a feeling, a kind of break where we do a certain movement might take us to another stage. And we'll come back and continue about these human exemplars. But what I wanted to share with you is a very simple experience that comes from the Mevlevi turning ceremony. I'm not going to ask you to whirl, but at the beginning of that ceremony, there's a procession. When the dervishes come in and they process around the sacred space with a certain step and a certain rhythm. And if we do this, we do this with the intention that it is worship, it is remembrance. But it's also a symbol of a journey that we are on. We are on it individually, and at this moment we are also on it together. So we feel our own step, or the steps of our own journey, keeping our awareness on each step as we take it. But we also feel the timelessness of the journey, the stages of the journey, and also we can feel the unity with our brothers and sisters who are also on this journey with us. The idea of sustaining a recollectedness, a state of remembrance in stillness and in action, is one of the things that most characterizes Sufism. A beautiful verse in the Quran describes houses in which God's name is remembered and people who remember God standing, sitting, and even lying down, and people who neither business nor profit and loss distract from the remembrance of God. So it doesn't propose a remembrance that is only sitting. It doesn't propose a state of spirituality that is only in stillness and solitude and silence. It proposes a state of remembrance through all of our activities. And that's why the Sufis have been given these practices, because we don't invent them of our own will. I could go into detail about every major practice, every movement in zikr, every aspect of turning. These things were inspired, usually through dream and vision, to our peers. They were given from a higher world, and people were told how to worship, how to do these things. Just as the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings, was shown the postures of Salat from a higher world. We don't design rituals. We don't invent ceremonies. But these ceremonies and these movements embody that remembrance. So would you like to do this? Would you like to get moved, developed enough, strong enough, clear enough? To move to the outer, to move with the outer. This is what all spiritual practice aims at. And in our tradition, especially, to live an integrated life, to face the incredible challenges of a whole industries of distraction. Millions of human identities formed, created by artificial media, by social conditioning, political conditioning, brainwashing, religious conditioning, without ever knowing the inside. The kind of human being that is needed today is not really qualitatively different from the kind of human being that has always been needed, but the challenges are perhaps greater because we've developed through our own intelligence and skillfulness incredible means of distraction, of confusion, of information overload. I think one of the challenges for youth in the coming times will be this confusion of identity that is the result of being bombarded with so many different kinds of images of selfhood. Most traditional cultures have grown out of some inspiration, out of, you know, Christianity grew out of the inspiration of Jesus, and Islamic civilization developed out of its inspiration. But now we live in a world that is where culture is literally a product of commercial interests. And the most fundamental, the most essential education, not just for mystics, I mean, this has gone beyond the mystics now, this is for every human being, needs this in a sense, needs a means of developing this inwardness. Now, I gave you the simplest imaginable example and practice, walking. Walking with this inwardness, with this zikr, with this remembrance. And you see for yourself something about the relationship, that the fluctuating relationship between inwardness and outwardness. And maybe you begin to feel something awakening in your own soul that's a little more complete, a little more full than just sitting here listening to a talk. We have to grow into the kinds of people that can bring consciousness to our fingertips and beyond, actually. Consciousness to every cell and limb of the body, and consciousness also to include, as we did today, a circle of people walking together, so that we know that our presence is expandable. We know that what you are has a center located somewhere here in your heart, but you have a periphery that extends through the universe. This is reality. This is even electromagnetic reality. But the majority of human beings, I'm afraid, at this time in history, are leading artificial, imitative lives. Lives where everything they know about themselves is borrowed and not authentic from their own experience. The beauty of the revelations that have come to humanity, the beauty of these revelations is that they are the instructions from the creator of humanness to the human being, saying how to be a human being. This is what Jesus teaches. This is what Muhammad teaches. This is what Abraham exemplified. This is what the prophet David sung about. All of life becomes the school to develop this complete inwardness. And when I say inwardness, I'm not talking about introversion, you understand? I'm not talking about thinking, being in our heads. I'm talking about a mindful awareness, an inner spaciousness that is free of thought. And when we need to use thought, we think. And we think with clarity and intentionality. But we also know how not to think. We know how to just see through the heart. We know how to explore the interior human presence, which is our greatest gift. What you are inside, the dimensions of your inner being, are limitless. What you are as a human being is essentially limitless. It has no boundaries. Otherwise, why would it be said, "My heavens and earth cannot contain me, only the heart of my faithful servant can contain me. If you look for me, look for me there." In order to achieve this, under the circumstances of modern life, we need what I would call a sacred matrix, a sacred pattern of living. The traditions give this to us, or your sheikh will give it to you. You know, I call it a matrix because a matrix is a structure, a pattern. This, for those of you who are Muslim, this is the true meaning of Shariat. Is not rigid laws. The true meaning of Shariat is this structure of practice that guides us to greater life. It gets turned into many other things. The degradation of pure spirituality seems to take two different courses among human beings. And this has been the story of all of the revelations that have come to this planet. Because they come as pure inspiration, pure mercy, and challenge, yes, invigoration of the human spirit. And then we human beings start to play around with it and kind of mess it up, sometimes mess it up really bad. There are two ways we mess it up. One is in the direction of burdening ourselves with man-invented prescriptions, rules, the burden of a false legalism. The other way we mess it up is through our own laziness and a kind of false freedom where we try to follow only the desires of our own ego or nafs, thinking that following the road of pleasure or listening to the promptings of the nafs or ego is a reliable way to happiness, and it simply isn't. It's the balance that seems to work. It is the healthy discipline that lets the nafs or self be under the guidance, direction of the spirit and heart. The spirit through the heart guides, directs the self. And then the self becomes an expression of that spirit. When the polarity reverses and the active force is coming from our nafs, the nafs itself is all too likely to be tyrannical. It tyrannizes our own hearts. Worse yet, it doesn't really know what it wants. It's fragmented. It has contradictory desires. It has no center. If we let the nafs rule us, we are ruled by 18,000 contradictory forces. If we let spirit be the center and heart be the center, then we have only one master to serve. And that master is infinitely generous, infinitely wise and beautiful. It's that to which we long to surrender with ever greater clarity and humility. And the prophets have all come to show us ways to do that. And saints like Rumi and Moinuddin Chisti and Abdul Qadir Jilani and many, many I could name, Bahauddin Naqshband and Ahmed Rifai and Shamsi Tabriz and on have come. And they have been beautiful expressions of humanity, of humility and power, of creativity. And knowledge. So this way is not an abstract way, and we don't love an abstract God. We love the God that is so hyper-personal, I would say. In other words, just as you are a person, we each are in some sense persons. Personhood resides in you. Well, that personhood that you have is a glimpse of the profound and immense and wise and deep personhood of divine reality that can speak and give us, inspire our hearts with a message that puts everything into perspective. We lose perspective so quickly, so easily. But one of the reasons why we value revelations and also the teachings of the Insan al-Kamil, the comprehensive, complete human being, like a Jesus, like a Rumi, is that these beings spoke from that state of communion, that universal humanity. And the teachings that they offered were not the subjective delusions of a human intellect. They were not the feeble attempts of a Marx or a Freud or a George Washington, for that matter, who created human products. But those who spoke from this state of completed humanity spoke from that wholeness of that wholeness. And it's they who give the truest glimpse into the meanings of revelation itself. Yes, we all should have a direct revelation, a relationship with revelation, with spiritual teaching. But we find in those beings who reached completion, we listen to how they understood these things. Take a look at, say, Rumi's Discourses, which was published under the title Signs of the Unseen. And look at how he interprets the Quran. What light does he bring to it? Look at the great Sufis. What did they find in the Quran, or what did they see in the words of Jesus? And it's extraordinary, and it's deep, and it's rich. So we need these exemplars. We need these human beings. Rumi tells a story in the Mesnevi of a baby had crawled out onto the edge of the roof, and this little baby was about to fall off a high roof. And the parents were in a panic, what to do. And I think as the story is told, it was Imam Ali, the beloved companion of the Prophet, who suggested, well, what you got to do is you've got to get another baby and send that other baby out on the roof. You know, like let that other baby get close. And one, the other baby will see this baby and will come away from the edge. God sending prophets to us is like that. To get us back from the edge of the roof. Something like that. And we have Hazrat Inayat Khan, and we have all these beautiful exemplars from whose lives we can learn. Learn what? Learn how to be a human being, fully conscious of our own divine inheritance, and that we are the beloved children of the divine. We don't have to earn God's love. We just have to learn how not to turn our back on it, turn away from it. The fundamental sin in our tradition, it's called kufr in Arabic, kufr. Unfortunately, it's often translated as non-belief, the non-believers. But kufr means denial. It means to be in the state of denial and ingratitude. And this is an archetypal human failing. And there are Muslims who practice kufr. There are Christians who practice kufr. There are atheists who practice kufr. It happens in every religion. And also in every religion, there are people who practice true faith. Iman, it's called. And for us, faith is not belief. Especially it's not belief in some irrational theology or theology. That's what I said, irrational theology. It's our certainty, our experiential certainty of the beneficence of the unseen or the divine intelligence. It's something that we verify for ourselves through action, through taking risks, through doing the right thing when faced with a choice, through trusting in God. That's how we develop this thing we call faith, iman. It's faith, and it also means security, and it also means verification. It means all three things. You're only secure when you are in relationship to that iman, that divine friend. So that's our choice, to turn, orient ourselves, to have a qibla, to have a direction in life, toward the source of life, towards the source of inspiration and love and wisdom, or to serve the ego, which will inevitably lead us into denial, denial of our own faults, the propagation of our own lies, fragmentation of our own lives, and the separation, and thingification, and othering that happens when the heart has become hardened and diseased. Here's how we explain it. God's will allows us free choice. God does not will evil. God wishes the good, but he allows good and evil. God's will is to allow good and evil. God is the creator of the darkness and the light. But he didn't create, the darkness is not created to put out the light, but to reveal it. We are in a soul-making, spirit-awakening existence. We are in such an existence that can bring forth the most beautiful divine qualities. Only in this life of sometimes, forgive me for saying this, of such ugliness. I don't believe the world is ugly, but we are ugly sometimes. In a world of ugly behavior and action, of true evil, evil meaning, and I define evil as those who take pleasure in causing pain to others, and there are such people. Only in these circumstances can the power of love adequately shine. In other words, only in this imperfect world can the power of love, which is perfection, come in and love even the imperfect. Because it's no, love deserves no credit for loving the lovable. You know, what's big about that? But love would not be love. Love would not be from the unconditioned world. It would not be love. It would not be divine if it could not come in and love even those who sin, those who are cruel, and redeem those people. That's the power of love. So within this whole divine ecology, suffering plays a role. It's an incredible drama. It's a little bit like, would you want to go see a movie that had no conflict? You know, screenwriters know that if you're going to write a good film, you've got to have conflict and you've got to have transformation. You've got to have somebody who changes, who undergoes a deep change. Otherwise, I'm sorry, it's not an interesting story. And we are all involved. Every one of us is involved in a very interesting story, aren't we? Through all this suffering, through our betrayals, through our losses, through our needs. And Rumi says the universe was created for satisfying needs, as Pir Zia said this morning from the teachings of Shams of Tabriz. Bring your need, your profound spiritual need, and lay it before the friend so that the friend will have the pleasure of satisfying your need. This is, that need is part of the ecology, it's part of the relationship, it is what, you know, really, we need each other. And we need God most of all. We need this thing we call God. And through humility, and I want to give you a definition of humility that maybe will serve you. Because humility is not meekness. One day a man was walking in front of the Prophet Muhammad and he was kind of slouched over and he was real meek. And the Prophet just kind of whacked him on the chest in an affectionate way. And he said, my brother, humility is not in the shoulders. You know, he says, it's in the heart. So what is humility? Humility is our awareness of our dependence on God and our interdependence with our fellow human beings. In other words, our need for each other and our need for God. This is humility. It's not having a low opinion of yourself. It's seeing reality. There's a very beautiful poem of Rumi's that I think captures something. Captures the beautiful nuances of this life of living and love that we experience. And one of the beauties of Rumi is that he presents us with a spirituality that has all the nuance of art. Now, I turn to the Quran when I want to cut through the illusion of my own ego, when I want to see things from the eternal perspective, because it has the language from that, you know, the voice of the Quran is not a human voice. You know, it's something else. But I turn to Rumi when I want the beautiful unfolding of those axioms that are contained in Revelation, but where those seeds of Revelation become whole gardens of beauty and richness. And to have a spirituality that has all the nuance of art and not just the cut and dry. I'm not saying the revelation is cut and dried, but it's more like the theory. And here with Rumi, we have the artfulness of the whole lived human experience, with all of its contradictions, and with love at the center. And this ghazal, which I've translated recently, is called The Urgency of Ishq. Ishq is the word, it's a Persian word, meaning the passionate love of the divine. If fortune is going to be your companion, love must have something to do with you. A life lived without love is no life. It adds up to nothing. In reality, we should be ashamed of any time that passes without love. Whatever is comfortable for you here will be a burden when it's time to leave. But to you who are at this moment grieved by love, it will be as forbearing as a father. And the poverty that you are ashamed of now will be a glory in the world to come. And however distasteful is the bitterness of patience, it will eventually taste delicious. The lion of your soul, when freed from this cage, will abide in the meadows of paradise. When dismounted from this donkey's carcass, the king of the heart will become a princely rider. Stretch out the arms of diligence and effort, so that gold may pour down from heaven. You were hidden to yourself, then made manifest. Everything hidden will one day be made clear. Whoever does not humble himself today will one day be debased like Pharaoh. Whoever does not melt like a rose in the fire will burn like a thorn. Whoever closes his eyes to the ready cash of present time will be the laughing stock of expectation. And whomever love chooses will be intoxicated and madly in love. And whoever is not reduced to drunkenness by love will forever suffer sobriety. And whoever does not bear the stigma of love in this moment will be like a camel, unbridled and abandoned. And whoever has no discernment in the eyes will be worthless and despised. Enough. Words settle like dust, and dust is all that will remain of them. Shams of Tabriz lays at rest, yet this heart is restless for him. You see the richness, the dimensions, the pain and the joy. Yeah, the pain and the joy of it all. Of a human being. Of someone whose own inner dimensions were expanded by the power of love, which came to him, by the way, miraculously through his contact with Shams of Tabriz. It took a human being to bring him to his fulfillment, even though he was a man of incredible. Rumi was a man of incredible knowledge. He had all the best spiritual training, including Sufi training, from his elders. He was an exemplary human being. but he still had to meet another human being and come into a relationship. And it was not the guru-disciple relationship. It was a relationship of something like equals, except that Shams of Tabriz was pure spiritual power and Rumi was pure beauty and receptivity. And Shams had only one purpose in his life. He said, you know, he was like grabbed by the collar. The unseen grabbed him by the collar and brought him to his station, to his attainment. But he lived his whole life only to pass on the power and beauty of this divine love to one other human being who could put it on the plate and serve it to humanity. And we have a little story in our tradition, which I only learned of this year. I came across it in a as yet unpublished manuscript in our tradition. But here's the story. In the time of Rumi's son, Veled, Sultan Veled, a delegation of people came all the way from Medina. They were of the tribe of the Quraysh. They were the keepers of the Prophet's tomb in Medina. Now this is the 13th century, early 14th century. And when they arrived in Konya, where Rumi's son was living, and they looked at Veled, and they were shocked because Veled tied his turban the same way this family tied their turban, and it was a unique way of doing it, not seen anywhere else. And these Arabs from Medina said to Veled, "What is this?" You know, Veled said, "Well, what? Why do you tie your turbans this way?" And they said, "Well, it goes back to the time of the Prophet. One day the Prophet had a vision. And in this vision he saw a magnificent being. And he said, 'Who is this? Is he a prophet I don't know about? Is he an archangel?' And God told the Prophet, they said, 'No, this is a man, just a man, who will come in later centuries to revive your religion. He will be descended from Abu Bakr.'" Abu Bakr was one of the Prophet's companions. "He will come in later centuries to revive your religion." And the Prophet was so full of joy that he wound his turban just like the turban he saw in that vision. And that vision was Rumi, also descended from Abu Bakr. And for me this was a confirmation that the love and mercy and beauty and creativity that Rumi represents is not something that stands aside from this line of prophetic revelation, but is smack in the middle of it, right at the core of it. And for that, I will be eternally grateful. Thank you. Peace be with you.